Hi, this is Artie Artisan, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Artie Artisan.
But before we do anything, once again, Colonel Vindman, every single day between now and the election, we need to remember Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration.
And of course, this fabulous group of people that helped me, Dave and Stephanie. But even equally fabulous is our first guest. Our first guest is Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And as we know, as Texas goes, so goes the nation. The question is, where the hell is it going in 2020? Welcome to the program, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well, Arnie. I'm in freezing cold Dallas, Texas this morning. Governor Abbott is ready to fire up the Republican troops. There are a few GOP primaries across the state this cycle, which is sort of underreported. Nobody really cares about that because it's all about the Democrats who are running for president, of course. Although there is an interesting dynamic. Right now, you have the Republicans in the state outvoting the Democrats by a decent amount, Arnie, which is sort of weird, right? Why is that happening when all of the action's on the presidential side? But there are a couple of things happening. And here are the numbers, by the way. Republicans, at least through the middle of this week, and of course this will air on Friday, so it'll be a little different by then. But Republicans right now are just over 650,000 who have voted across Texas. Democrats are at 536,000 or so. Some folks had asked me, what's up with that? If all the action's in that Democratic primary for president, well, you had the fact that Democrats here, and this is anecdotal, Arnie, but I think there's something to it. One Democrat after another tells me they were waiting to vote because they wanted to see what was going to happen in Nevada, in South Carolina,
which
of course is still coming up tomorrow,
right,
since we're talking here.
I completely understand
on Friday.
That answer.
And by the way, after the South Carolina primary, and you know, it seems like Vice President Biden might do well there. That's the big question, right, hanging over everybody's head. And that, if they wait until the South Carolina primary, then they'll have no choice in Texas but to vote on Super Tuesday because early voting will be closed by then. Mm. And so we could see the same kind of incredibly long lines that we saw in 2008,
wow,
when Senator at the time, Clinton and Senator Obama, were still battling it out for the Democratic nomination back in 08 when John McCain had already, sewn up the Republican nomination. I was thinking about the fact, Arnie, that, for Republicans, it's just that if you win, you win, right? If you win, you win, winner take all. And that's why the nominating contest for the Republicans is a little different. Mm-hmm. With Democrats, they hand out participation trophies. You know, in Texas.
What a great line.
And I was thinking about this the other day. The Texas Democratic Party, is going to be looking at all this, and they told us that we may see the results out of Texas after midnight on Tuesday. So be ready for a long night. You know, mm-hmm, after all of the counties have reported, 254 counties across two time zones in this state of 30 million people, with 16 million people registered to vote. We'll see what exactly unfolds. But here's the short version. If you get 15% support across the whole state, well, you are awarded delegates for that in a certain fashion. But then if you're also able to create support at 15% or more in each individual state Senate district, mm-hmm, all around Texas, then you also are awarded delegates for that. And the way it works, again, sort of the shorthand redneck version of it is, if you are able to win delegates out of Houston, for example, you would get more delegates. If it's Amarillo, where there are fewer Democrats out in West Texas, you would get fewer delegates for that. I was just looking at this morning, Pete Buttigieg, who does not have nearly the kind of cash on hand that some of the more top-tier candidates have, although he had done well in fundraising at one point there. Mm-hmm. But he's been buying television in small markets around Texas, including, I think, Amarillo and Wichita Falls. Right. And people said, well, what's up with that? Well, if a candidate like that is trying to stay in the hunt and they can't afford television like Mike Bloomberg in Houston, where he's able to just drop a $1 million check every week if he wants to, they could maybe round up some delegates in those smaller places. And Bloomberg is also participating in those small places. We might have talked about it, but out in Abilene, for example, lots of television purchased by Mike Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. If you are a Democratic candidate and you have that kind of resources, you would play in every single market available.
Right.
True in the other states as well. So I think folks, when they think that, you know, only the big markets like Houston and Dallas really matter, when it comes down to trying to force a brokered convention, which it seems like that's what Bloomberg's strategy, at least part of it is, then he would want to compete in every single place. So it's lots going on here.
Right. And I actually think Bloomberg wants to be the kingmaker, not necessarily the king. And I think that's going to be his influence. And what's so interesting is, let me send a bouquet of flowers out to Texas voters, especially Democratic voters, and say, I get it. I know why you haven't voted yet. Mm-hmm. As I reminded you, No, it's not a lack of conviction.
Stop it.
I'm going to give you a knuckle sandwich.
These people, get out. Let me say something. Let me say one thing real quick. And I'm saying this on social media.
Yep.
I'll say it on the radio.
Right.
I'll say it on television.
Right.
As public figures, Arnie, you and I have a responsibility to say, go vote. No matter what you're thinking, go vote. Especially in Texas. Well, hang on. In Texas, which has the lowest voter participation in the country.
Right.
Telling people to wait to exercise the franchise is not right.
Given that, you know exactly what I'm going to say.
Folks don't want to vote for somebody who by Tuesday may have dropped out.
That's not what I'm going to say.
And look, if you've made up your mind about who you think the president ought to be, go pick that person.
So Bloomberg is kind of, he basically sort of came in thinking that Biden was kind of a wounded animal. Well, we're going to find out whether the numbers are, is he in double digits ahead in South Carolina? Is he in single digits? Is it going to be Bernie that comes in second? Or is it going to be Elizabeth that comes in second? Or is it going to be Tom Steyer? I think this is, for Democrats, this is a very challenging choice. I am sorry. People are not voting because they don't want to exercise the franchise. The people that are making the decision to vote on Super Tuesday.
Keep going.
I know. But the people that are deciding to vote on Super Tuesday are people who are willing to say, I know there may be long lines, but at least I will know why I'm making the decision I'm making. I feel it's premature if I vote on Friday.
This is really why we should go back to the party bosses picking the nominees. Voters are not good at this.
You are such a what a
voters
beast.
Voters are not good at this. And everybody trying to pick a winner instead of picking who they think ought to be the chief executive officer of the United States.
I ended up voting for who I thought should be the chief executive officer. That mm-hmm. was my choice. I did not vote for who I necessarily thought would be the winner because I'm not even sure what the winner looks like anymore. I just put something out on Facebook and on Twitter, and here's what I said. You know how they refer to Bernie Sanders as a socialist, and I know we're going to get into Bernie next. I said, but there are two socialists. There are dueling socialists. One is Donald Trump, who's a socialist for the 1%, and then there's Bernie, who's the socialist for the rest of us. Understand, Donald Trump is a socialist. He massages everything that enhances the wealth of the 1%. He aids them. He abets them. He deregulates them. He enhances them. And Bernie says, okay, I will aid and abet everybody else who's a working guy. So they're both socialists. Well, I think what you do is you turn the tables. You don't run away from the word. You use the word as your hammer and not your Achilles heel. Sorry. Let's get into Bernie, though, as it relates to Texas.
We're looking at another 20-point blowout in Texas.
And I want to hear that.
Democratic socialist who wants to not only a Democratic socialist, one who wants to ban fracking in a state that is heavily reliant on the oil and gas industry for its economy. You know, we talk about the boom and bust nature of the oil and gas industry.
I do know that.
You know, since the 80s, the economy of Texas has greatly diversified.
Mm-hmm.
However, economists will tell you, the number one single indicator of the overall health of the economic state of Texas is the price of a barrel of oil. And if you think about who the frontline Democrats are, you know, they had Lizzie Fletcher in Houston, for example,
right.
Who beat a Republican in the last cycle. Colin Allred here in Dallas, where I'm talking to you from,
right.
Who beat a Republican in the last cycle. The Republicans are coming on strong, Arnie, because when someone is new in office, when they're a freshman, that's when you can beat them, right? Once they've been in there two or three terms, then they're sort of entrenched and they become
exactly.
harder to dislodge. Not that you can't do it, but this is when those Democrats are especially vulnerable to a challenge from
true.
A Republican. Lizzie Fletcher in Houston represents an area called the Energy Corridor in West Houston. It's the former congressional district that was held by George H.W. Bush. It's sort of known as the cradle of the Republican establishment in the United States. And there were a lot of crossovers, a lot of folks who are Republicans, disaffected Republicans, who voted for the Democrat in that area. Same thing in Dallas. There were 400,000 people all across the state of Texas, Arnie, who voted for Governor Greg Abbott, who's a conservative,
mm-hmm.
and Beto O'Rourke, who is something a little different than what
yeah.
he is now, I think.
I know.
But he was a little more progressive than Greg Abbott, for sure. Would they do that? Would those 400,000 still cross over if you had somebody like Beto now, who wants to punish churches with loss of their tax-exempt status if they don't agree with gay marriage, or wants to confiscate certain firearms? We're talking about socialist programs, democratic programs, and wants to ban fracking in places like South Texas, where they are heavily reliant on oil and gas for their economy. And a lot of those people are Democrats. They'll tell you they're Democrats, but they don't want to vote for somebody like that. I'm trying to figure out exactly what the argument is for Sanders to get there. I was looking at the fact, Arnie, that in 2016, here are the numbers, because mm-hmm. what does Bernie keep saying? What's the Sanders argument? Youth vote.
Right,
the
youth,
young votes
yeah,
will,
know,
that will get out there and they will help elect him. And that's got to be a part of, that has to be part of a coalition, a broader coalition,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But driving up the youth vote on its own won't do it. In Texas, in 2016, according to the CNN exit poll, I've got it right here, 37% of the electorate was 45 or younger. And our friend, who you know, Glenn Smith, mm-hmm. Here, who ran Ann Richards' campaign back in the day, more recently has advised Lena Hidalgo, who's the Harris mm-hmm. County judge in Houston, one of the youngest people to run one of the largest counties in the United States. Glenn crunched the numbers on this, Arnie. If you basically took the numbers that we had in 2016 and you cranked it all the way up on the dial to hard rock, and you said, okay, we'll have youth turnout or younger turnout at 55% instead, which sounds crazy. It's almost a 20-point jump.
Right.
And you boosted the turnout in Texas to an unprecedented 10.5 million people. You know what the election result still is?
Yeah.
With the extrapolate
Trump.
The same numbers?
Trump.
Sanders still loses to Trump. Even if you have a scenario that you couldn't even make happen. So I think there has to be some realism that gets injected into this. Now, you do have people saying, look, we have a very small amount of the delegates that have been awarded so far, right? We'll get to Super Tuesday after we see South Carolina and whether or not Biden's toast or not get to Super Tuesday and see what happens. But I think a real danger for the Democrats, you tell me, Arnie, grade my paper, is that you still have a muddled sort of mess coming out of Super Tuesday.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. But let me just say one more thing. So I was listening to the press conference. Again, everyone, we taped the show on Thursday for Friday, so I apologize. But I was listening to the press conference yesterday with Donald Trump talking about coronavirus. And
yes.
I'm just going to remind and I'm just going to remind everyone that not only does coronavirus test Donald Trump's ability to respond to perhaps a national calamity, it's also going to question a lot of things. Our public health system, the fact that we have such a high number of uninsured and underinsured. And let me speak directly to Houston, Texas, because you have taught me so
Please.
Much. Houston, Texas, you have 600,000 undocumented immigrants. Those are people that cannot access the healthcare system the way people who actually have insurance or could qualify for Medicaid. There is a virtue. There is a virtue to universal healthcare. Universal healthcare doesn't ask you what your citizenship status is. It says, are you sick? So what's going to be so interesting for Texas that has such a huge number of undocumented immigrants that they depend on, and you know that, and I know that. How are they going to respond to this? And you're going to say, I know they can't vote.
I love you, Arnie. The people who are talking about can't vote.
I don't disagree with that. I am not talking about that. I am talking about the vulnerability that is being created by Donald Trump. You know what? And I think I understand the oil and gas and fracking. What I am going to say to you is, as we move forward on climate change, there has to be an adjustment about oil, coal, and gas. I get
that. But banning it, that's not the way to go.
Well, but first of all, can we be honest? honest here, he's not going to be able to do that, and you know damn well. And the reason
you don't know how that's going to play in the election.
Well, I understand. So let's teach people about politics. Politics is about staking something out, and then you don't compromise at the beginning. Scott, I love you. You compromise at the end. Trust me, Bernie will be forced to compromise. The question is the direction that he goes in. And if he goes in a direction that wants to sort of quote-unquote ban things, what he may be able to do is buy out fracking. What he may be able to do is make adjustments. And I understand what he's saying, and I understand that people are voting on the black or white, but, oh, God, they just don't get it. Politics isn't black and white. That's not how policy is made. Am I right?
Well, we're talking about a senator whose some of his greatest accomplishments, I think, are renaming post office buildings.
I know.
I'm very cynical about Bernie. I sit here and I think that he's not been a compromiser over the years, hasn't passed legislation in Washington. He's got some amendments passed and things like that. But it's almost like if Ron Paul was on the cusp of getting the nomination, which I never would think in my lifetime would be the same.
I mentioned this to you in an email before. A year and a half ago, everyone, here's what Arnie Arneson said. I got a knuckle sandwich from both sides. I said I didn't want Biden or Bernie to run. We have the tape. We have the Facebook post. We have the Twitter feed. And the reason is that Bernie is stuck in an old language of 40 years ago. Let me just say something. The Bernie of today, he ain't a damn socialist. He's, believe it or not, he's not. The kinds of things he's talking about, when you look at the Nordic models that he keeps referring to, they don't even call themselves socialists.
Right.
So I just look at him and I'm going, I want to wash your mouth out with soap. You know,
stop saying that.
Well, I know, but you're in a word rut that you have been using over and over again. Even the Swedes and the Scandinavians and the Danes and the Finns, they don't use that word anymore. So I just think it's just so ironic that that's part of our problem. And if he hadn't run and if Biden hadn't run, we'd be having a very different conversation today. It would not be about not a progressive message. It would be that we wouldn't be stuck running away from a guy we're propping up who's sort of like, you know, hearing dead people, which is Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders, who, you know, basically thinks it's 1966, and it just isn't. All right,
Arnie,
I'm done.
Yes. I mean,
if you
want to tank every Democrat. By the way, let me make one other point about how important this is for Texas, because it's the place that I love. A Bernie Sanders ticket, brand the guy. He self-brands it. He doesn't have to have Trump do it.
So,
like you said, he needs to stop saying that. He self-brands as a Democratic socialist, wants to ban one of the ways that we make our living around here. And by the way, those are Republicans and Democrats who work in the oil and gas industry, and all that money spends the same.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a ticket like that, you can kiss goodbye to probably most or all of the Democratic gains that were made in this state. 12 new Democrats in the Texas House, 2 new Democrats in the Texas Senate, 2 congressional districts that flipped from red to blue, and we are coming up on a redistricting year. And if the Democrats are not able to be competitive, potentially take the Texas House of Representatives as a majority there, but if they're not able to do that and they just get set back once again, then that will put the Republican Party in complete control of what? Of allocation of power, which is what happens in redistricting.
I know, and
Republicans will cement their power going forward for the next decade based on this pipe dream of democratic socialism.
So let me just say something. So you think Biden will deliver?
Potentially, absolutely. I don't know that he can win Texas. I'm not arguing that. I still think the president would win Texas. But just about every Republicans and Democrats who campaign minds, some of the best people, Arnie, we've got them. They're saying somebody like Biden, even somebody like Warren, wouldn't do as much damage as somebody like Sanders in this state. This is not going to work out.
Oh, God. All right. We have one last comment to talk about before I let you go. And that is that Saturday Night Live comedian Pete Davidson jokes he was told to apologize to Representative Dan Crenshaw so that I didn't get shot in the face. I missed that. So tell me about Saturday Night Live.
It's so funny. You remember that Pete Davidson and Dan Crenshaw, who's sort of a conservative rock star Republican congressman from the Houston area, that they had gotten into it. When Davidson had said that he had made fun of the eye patch that Crenshaw wears, he suffered an injury in the theater of war. And now Davidson, they did a bit there on Saturday Night Live where they sort of made fun of it and made fun of each other, and it sort of rocketed he actually gave Crenshaw a lot of credibility with some liberals and people in the middle that he was able to go and laugh at himself on Saturday Night Live. Well, now you have Davidson saying, well, you know, he was forced to apologize and, you know, that he might get shot because you have this military guy and the far right, as you could put it, the far right crazies, you know, would come after him. Just kind of a funny deal. But it's interesting. Crenshaw is somebody who has been moving more to the middle in a congressional district in Texas that you would think would just be a lot for Republicans. But to your point about climate change, fracking, and all of that, Crenshaw is one of the guys on the Republican side who has said fairly recently, in the last couple of months, that you can't just keep making fun of the left, quote-unquote, as he said it, that you have to recognize that climate change is real, and the real discussion is what we should be doing about it. He's also one of the Republicans who has said that the Republican Party of Texas, which will once again you know, be looking at this issue over the next couple of months, that they should welcome the log cabin Republicans, the LGBTQ Republicans into the fold, when you have the leadership of the Republican Party saying no in this state, that they're not, they're not willing to do that. So there's a reason that these sort of pop culture moments like this are important for a Republican like that, who's in that sort of position, right? Because he's trying to reach out into a more broad coalition, not just the conservative right wing of the state, which has usually produced victories for those Republicans.
So has anyone, it's now that Crenshaw is beginning to sort of at least articulate some message about climate change, what is the solution? I feel like the conversation we were just having about Texas, that, you know, Texas is so dependent on oil, coal, and oil and gas and fracking.
Not coal.
And not coal. I know. That's Virginia. That's not you.
Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania.
No, I won't. Or West Virginia. But I will mix you up. I will compare you to Australia. Mm-hmm. Australia's major export is coal. It defines the country. It is the income for the country. They are now flipping out because they're burning alive, okay? And they recognize that coal is one of the biggest contributors to kind of the – it's terrible. So as they are trying to figure out how they address going forward as an economy, recognizing that climate change is burning them and they continue to mine coal, I would love to sit down with Mr. Crenshaw, Representative Crenshaw, and say, so let's talk about climate change. How do you have a conversation in a place that is so dependent, although it is diversified? Again, I want to remind my audience outside of Texas that the largest producer of wind energy in the United States is, guess what, is Texas. So you have at least embraced the idea that there are alternatives and that alternatives work, but they're not necessarily as financially successful or as lucrative as oil and gas. So I guess the question is, Texas has the same issue to address as Australia has. How do you address climate change when you realize what you were so dependent on as an economy is the biggest driver of climate change? So what is Is it economic suicide?
Let me help you with the frame. It's closer, right? But look, they're a big coal country. We're not. Obama was pursuing his clean energy initiatives, you know who supported that? The American Natural Gas Association, ANGA, and the Texas Natural Gas Association. Natural gas is the bridge. This is what Secretary Clinton talked about in 16 in her energy policy. She said, look, you got to have all of the above approach, right? You got to look at wind. You got to look at solar. You got to look at natural gas as a bridge, because it's not the cleanest thing ever, but it's certainly not coal, right? And so you have to ease people over to the other thing. You can't just flip the switch and suddenly we're on this other thing that we've never been on before. That's not going to work. And I think guys like Crenshaw are talking about that. John Cornyn has talked about that. Secretary Clinton talked about that. President Obama was on, you know, on that page. And when Democrats try to, you know, make everybody is to try to give people whiplash, like we're going to move from one to the other real fast. I think to your point, that's maybe a good bargaining position to start from. But the compromise is, let's have a bridge to the future. Let's move toward natural gas, liquefied natural gas, which is what we're now exporting out of Texas.
So let's
it that way rather than try to shut down a whole economy.
Okay, so I was taught this by the vice president of Kenya. And let me tell you what the vice president of Kenya, Uncle Moody, told me. Uncle Moody was talking about change in Kenya. And he said, so here's how I'm going to describe change for you, Arnie. In one hand, I have a glass full of ice. In the other hand, I have a pot of boiling water. If I pour the pot of boiling water into the glass with the ice, what happens? The glass shatters in my hand.
Right.
If I drip bits of boiling water into the glass with the ice, it melts. I end up with that glass of water, but I still have a glass. And there's a piece of me that hears you say what you are saying, that we have to understand it's not a switch. And on that note, I need to switch you off. Scott
Braddock.
Beautifully
said, Arnie. Thank you.
Scott Braddock is the editor.
You shut me down anytime.
I love you. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. Talk to you next week, Scott. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. We're actually doing another story about Texas. But this is about the news industry. We'll be right back.
Good fences make good water. On this current cast. Cows wading in a stream might make a pretty picture, but the reality is a lot less pleasant. Gene Kahn is a microbiologist with Stroud Research Center. He's been monitoring streams in the Delaware River watershed for bacteria that are present as a result of fecal contamination. And he's found high levels, especially in summer.
We try to understand why we have that high number of bacteria and how can we reduce those bacteria.
Ken says possible causes include leaky septic systems and runoff from nearby farm fields. But wading cows also contribute by excreting waste directly in the water. So he says fencing livestock out of streams can help protect water quality. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
My mom's
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. And this is actually another conversation about Texas, but not with a guy from Texas. Joining me right now is I believe he's a journalism professor from Northeastern University in Massachusetts. I see him on WGBH on a regular basis, Beat the Press. He has written books. He has written for many journalist outlets for years and years and years. But what intrigued me was an article that I saw at WGBH. And it was entitled, Burgers, Beers, and a Texas Experiment Points the Way to News as the Hub of Civic Life. I went, beers, burgers, and journalism? Oh, my God, I must have missed this story. So joining us right now is Professor Dan Kennedy, or my friend Dan Kennedy. How are you, Dan?
How are you, Arnie?
I'm terrific. So give people a little bit more about your history, because we're going to be talking about sort of the struggling nature of journalism. You teach young people who maybe have an interest in this, but give them a little bit of who you were, who you are today. And in a lot of ways, your life story is really the story of journalism in America.
It really is. I mean, I'm older than dirt, which means that I came into the business at a time when it was really at its peak in some ways, in the late 70s and early 80s. And I watched its decline over lo these many years. I worked in community journalism for the first 10 years of my career at a little paper in Woburn, Massachusetts called the Daily Times Chronicle. Mm-hmm. And I should point out that they are still owned by the same family and doing good work.
Oh, good.
And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as we look at what's happened to newspapers. I think that the rise of corporate chain ownership has had at least as much to do with the decline of journalism as technology and Facebook and Google and all the other things we know about. Mm-hmm. And then I worked for quite a few years at the late, much lamented Boston Phoenix, and I was their media columnist most of the time. They were one of the great alt weeklies, and like so many of those alt weeklies, they have ceased to exist. And let me pause there for a moment. They had some particular problems. The alt weeklies in general had a problem in that they were free newspapers, free websites, and in the end, very few ads.
Right.
What we see among newspapers that are doing fairly well today is that they are moving toward a pretty robust push toward digital subscriptions.
Right.
And there are some that are doing quite well on the national level. And what we need is to see that work on the regional and local level as well. And for the past 15 years, I've been at Northeastern University teaching journalism and researching and writing about these topics.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I so value your voice, and I'm so glad you're back on the air with me. And so let's talk about this story about this Texas experiment. I kind of love it. And the reason I kind of love it is that my daughter was talking about at one point opening up a laundromat. But the laundromat was also going to have a place to eat and a music venue. So she was, you know, what is it called? Suds and buds and what, I don't know what it was. But anyway, the idea of combining different elements with things that people need. People need to eat, but they also need to know about their community. And the idea of combining these two together sounds a little foreign, but tell me about this experiment in Marfa, Texas.
Well, I have to say, this was a story that I saw in the New York Times a week ago, and it immediately brought back 10-year-old memories of some experiments that people were trying then.
Right.
But first, the Texas experiment, a little paper in Marfa, Texas, called the Big Bend Sentinel, bought a building that had been many things over the years, including a dive bar. And if I'm remembering correctly, it might have been a laundromat at one time.
See, there you go.
And they have converted it into a cafe, a bar, and a wedding venue. There's a number of couples that have gotten married there. And in this adjacent space, you've got the reporters working.
Wow.
And the way the New York Times portrays this, it's intended to bring in money.
Right.
I mean, how do you offset the decline of advertising revenues? Right. Well, this is one way. You sell them cheeseburgers and beer. But I really think that the Times story kind of misses the real potential of this, mm-hmm. which is that it's a civic space where people gather.
Thank you.
And you've got essentially journalism built around civic engagement.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that was one of the reasons why I'm going to send you my Facebook post, because that's one of the reasons why I suggested it, because I kept thinking the Concord Monitor is a struggling paper, but it is the paper for the state capitol. What do we know about the state capitol? Everybody shows up at the state capitol. Plus, there's the local community as well as, you know, the politicians and everything else. Imagine if they could create a space where, A, civic engagement took place. It would be a civic duty to eat there because you're also supporting the paper, which, think about it. You think you're eating your burger, but you're also supporting journalism, which is kind of a twofer. And at the same time, look at the opportunity to reach into an incredible blend of sort of local community leaders, state leaders, even national leaders, because there is a raison d'etre to show up there, because journalism is happening and so is food. And you and I both know that food is the best way of getting people to talk and come together, because we all need to eat, even though we don't realize we all need journalism as well. And it just weds the two together. So I think you're absolutely right. This is such an interesting way of blending things together. It isn't just about a revenue device. It is about the Velcro that holds a community together.
And let me tell you a little bit about how this idea started,
okay.
because you had this idea was nipped in the bud 10 years ago by the rise of hedge funds, unfortunately. There was a very innovative young publisher named Matt Dorenzo who worked for, he worked for a chain that was fairly progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And he started something called the Newsroom Cafe at the paper in Torrington, Connecticut. And I'm blanking on the name of the paper at the moment. It's a little bitty paper.
Okay.
The Register Citizen, that's it.
Okay.
And what they did was they opened up to the public. And they said, come on in, get a coffee, get a muffin. They weren't serving alcohol, unlike the Texas paper.
Uh-huh.
And you know, use our archives for free, meet our journalists.
Wow.
And it was this terrific experiment. And he got promoted to a position where he was going to try this with a much bigger paper, the New Haven Register.
Right.
They had this big plant down by the interstate, mm-hmm. surrounded by barbed wire. they closed the plant. They outsourced the printing because they didn't need that much capacity anymore. And Matt was making plans to open a similar space right on the New Haven Green on the Yale side.
Right.
And it never happened because the chain ended up getting acquired by Alden Global Capital, which is the worst of the newspaper chains. They run a chain called Media News Group.
Okay.
It used to be called Digital First Media, but mm-hmm. they changed the name. I like to joke that they're the first newspaper chain that entered the Witness Protection Program.
Oh, God.
But this was such a great idea,
yes.
and it really would have helped build that civic engagement. And it just got killed before it really even got off the ground. So we do see little things like this here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there are plenty of local news organizations that will have events at restaurants and bars and things like that. I'm actually going out to visit such an event in California next week. But the idea of a newspaper actually, you know, opening and operating a bar or restaurant as the folks in Marfa, Texas has done, that's pretty innovative, and I think it's a fantastic idea.
No, I I'm going to share a couple of thoughts with you as I'm listening to this. So my first job in New Hampshire was working for a poverty agency called the Listen Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Do you know how we funded virtually most of our programs other than whatever we got in federal dollars and a couple of bucks that we got maybe from the state or the county? We had a thrift store. Okay. And the thrift store, and the thrift, today, the Listen Center has the most successful thrift store probably north of Concord. It's huge. It took over an entire furniture store that was like maybe two blocks long. Everybody sees it as a place where they volunteer. They see it as a place where they donate. And they realize that when they're donating, they can actually see what they're donating to because it's going into food programs. It's going into the pantry. It's going into weatherization. It's going into this. It has turned out to be an enormous revenue generator that helps them expand their outreach into the community, even as there's an unevenness of kind of what sustains them from the feds. And it is a brilliant idea. They did it. They're wildly successful. It is not uncommon. The Salvation Army is another perfect example of doing this. The idea that journalists would do this is not surprising as well. But let me ask you something else. The reason I think I'm a little bit nervous about people really valuing how important journalism is that we haven't really not only not taught civics in elementary school and high school, we haven't given people sort of the hunger and the muscle for it. And Dan, when I was a kid, my father would give a current events test every single Monday to his high school students in Far Rockaway, New York. They were expected to read papers every single week. I would love to have all the social studies teachers call me right now and tell me how many of them give a current events test. I bet you the answer would be none, all right? Would be none.
Yep.
And the other thing is that this is another thing, just to show you how kids want to be engaged. They just don't know because a switch has never been turned on. I used to be a program director at a Girl Scout camp. And we had to give the news every day about, you know, what the weather was going to be like and what programs were going to be happening at the Girl Scout camp. And there were hundreds and hundreds of girls at this camp, ranging in age from 6 to probably 15. Do you know what I did? I formed a radio station, 98.6 on the Girl Scout dial. Not only did we do the weather and we did the news about camp, we had Dan Rather Not with the national and international news. We had my kids learned more about what was happening in the world by what we did at Girl Scout camp every single day. And their parents would see me at the end of 2 weeks going, "How does my kid know about this? How does my kid question me about this? I don't even know what they're talking about." We actually educated their kids, and not only did they want to know, but they remembered and challenged their parents. Part of the problem is we haven't really restored that muscle.
No, we haven't. And I think that successful local news organizations of the present and future are not going to just have to cover community life. They're going to have to be involved in re-sparking community life. And this is one of the ways that, that people are doing it. A number of years ago, I interviewed a very smart journalist named Mark Oppenheimer. He used to write the religion column for the New York Times. And I always remember one of the things he told me was that people in his generation, he found, after they got out of college, they all went to one of five places. They went to San Francisco or New York or Washington or Silicon Valley, Seattle, I guess. And he said, as a result, they had more in common with their peers in these small number of tech-oriented cities than they did with their community.
Right.
And maybe they cared about national news, and certainly we've seen a huge increase in interest in national news as a result of what's been going on the last few years, but they had no interest in local news.
Right.
And we almost have to teach people to be interested in local news, and we need to do it in a way that they find, I don't want to use the word fun, but interesting and engaging, and not like, well, you know, you should read the zoning board story from last night because it's good for you.
Right.
No, we need to show people how this matters to their lives. Frankly, more than what happens in Washington.
Right. Well, and what's so interesting is that what I keep hearing now, especially as we're talking about who should be elected the next president of the United States, and I may not be necessarily pointing to Bloomberg or Mayor Pete, but there is this idea that maybe mayors would make better presidents. And the reason why we hear this over and over again is that mayors actually live with the failure of policy at the national and state level, and they can't accept that failure because they need to keep their city together. They need to address the educational needs. They need to address the coronavirus needs. They need to figure out how to fill the potholes.
Sure.
They need, and it's so interesting to me because in a lot of ways, what you're talking about vis-a-vis journalism is even as Washington is distasteful and doesn't seem to accomplish anything, guess what? It all happens within your community. And if your community fails, you fail immediately. You know, Washington may be delayed failure, but this is immediate failure. And I think that's another reason why we want to do this. As you've been looking and studying journalism, there's also the other idea about the nonprofit model. And so one of the most successful nonprofits, believe it or not, takes place in the state of Vermont. And Vermont has something called VT Digger, okay? And VT Digger actually has been more successful than the Burlington Free Press, and I'm not even sure half these papers still exist, but they do this, and they're the nonprofit model. Is that an answer? And when I was reading the New York Times piece, Dan Kennedy, I was reading the comments. The comments sometimes are really, really fascinating. And one of the comments I thought was interesting was a guy who said, you know what? Newspapers and cable stations are basically sort of sucking the energy out of journalists, and they're not necessarily providing the content we need, but they're definitely raking in the revenue, all right? And
yeah.
He said maybe there should be a journalism tax on them. And that the tax on these cable and TV stations would be a way to start funding the coverage of real journalism, investigative journalism that's taking place in your state and in your local communities as a way to sort of, you know, when you kind of, you know what you see public access TV, you may see public access radio or whatever. That's kind of a tax on cable. Well, maybe
right.
What we need to do is expand that concept and actually use some of that incredible revenue that, you know, is paid to getting us dribble and actually using some of that revenue and reinvesting it in the journalists that, frankly, even cable news needs.
Well, we'll have to discuss whether government should directly be funding journalism on another day, Arnie.
Yeah.
But you know, I wrote about VT Digger in my most recent book, The Return of the Moguls. It's a fantastic model.
All right.
And the thing is, we've had nonprofit news organizations right in our face, and we don't necessarily even think about it for a very long period of time. And I'm talking about public radio and public television.
Right.
And especially as newspapers are less able to carry out their civic mission, we've seen public radio stations expanding what they do locally,
right.
Adding some digital-only content, and trying to fill that gap. Now, interestingly enough, earlier this year, the Salt Lake Tribune announced that they were going to try to become the first purely nonprofit regional newspaper in the country. Hmm. And there were observers who said, you know, good luck to them. The IRS may drag this out for ages.
Yeah.
And in a couple of months, the IRS said, go ahead.
Wow.
Which was pretty interesting. And so they are moving in that direction. Now, does it solve all their problems? No. They still have to take in as much money as they spend. But on the other hand, we know that there are tax advantages. They can get grant money and underwriting money
and all
of that.
Right.
And so good luck to them. Interestingly, as a nonprofit, they won't be able to do one of the things that probably is yours and mine favorite activities of newspapers.
Politics.
They won't be able to endorse candidates.
Right, right.
That would endanger their nonprofit.
But you know
status.
What? You and I both know that endorsements probably have less meaning anyway. And if you're only going to lose the endorsement, go for it, honey bun. I want to see you successful at actually covering the stories and let me endorse the candidate with my vote. You know,
I agree. Although endorsements can be useful at the local level when there's a lot of candidates for, city council or something, and the voters are really having a hard time.
So let
I certainly agree that with presidential. Who cares?
Who cares?
Nobody cares.
Well, so let me go back to something you said. So I found your story, Dan Kennedy, at WGBH.org. Okay? And WGBH.org is a big public TV as well as public radio station in the Massachusetts area. I also do WGBH. I do a show called Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. What I find interesting, and you're absolutely right, we do have these nonprofits like facing us in our face. And what I'm seeing with my local New Hampshire public radio, and I'm curious as to whether this model is being replicated everywhere, as we're seeing the papers die and we're seeing some of the institutional memory disappear because the best reporters are being the first ones to ask to leave. So they don't have a history. They have a couple of cub reporters if they're surviving at all, and they're not offering the kind of investigative journalism and journalism. What I am seeing happening now at New Hampshire Public Radio, and I suspect you may be also seeing it at WGBH, is that these nonprofits are now hiring those people that used to work for Foster's Daily Democrat, that used to work for the Union Leader, that used to work for the Nashua Telegraph, and they're bringing them on. And they're offering a digital content and a story content and an investigative story content that they didn't do before, but now they are doing. And in some ways, they are becoming sort of a version of public radio and VT Digger. They're sort of doing the work of some of the journalism that we used to see happening at the local level with these papers. And in a way, I just hope they understand their obligation now. If they're going to be so financially successful, if they're going to bring some of these people in, then they really need to support a broad range of investigations. And the only fear I have, and you know this and I know that, is that once you are sort of wedded to donors, your donors can also sort of craft the parameters of what you are able to do. And there's always the fear of that.
Yeah, there is. I would say that we've definitely seen that in Boston with the the funny thing about Boston is the Boston Globe, which is the big regional paper here, has actually been able to maintain what it does in a better way than most papers.
Right.
And they even claim to be profitable. So we haven't seen this exodus of people onto the unemployment lines the way we have in other places. But I would say that even in Boston, the two big public media operations, WGBH and our competitor, WBUR, probably ought to be looked at as the equivalent of the number two paper these days.
Exactly, exactly.
Because the number two daily in Boston, the Herald, ended up getting scooped up by Alden Global Capital, and they have been cut to pretty much nothing at this point.
Well, I think, and you know what? I think you should say that. I think you need to write a piece about that, because I think people need to understand, and I go to New Hampshire Public Radio now for content, not just to hear the audio. If I didn't hear it, you know, on the radio, it doesn't mean that there isn't additional content there, or there are additional stories there that have nothing to do with what I'm hearing on the radio, because they're giving me added value. That added value has become important, but to a large extent, we need to tell people that that's where they can go. I mean, you and I may know it because we see it or we do it ourselves, but I think this is important. And then again, it becomes the idea of the nonprofit model beginning to do what unfortunately for-profit journalists can't do anymore, because they've been so either through consolidation or decimated financially by the hedge funds that took over, that didn't give a crap about journalism, just saw it as an opportunity for them to sort of get, you know, add to their profit line.
Yeah. Absolutely. But there's great things about the for-profit model if we can keep it alive, and I think we can. I think that especially as we move to reader-supported publications, which is what the business has had to embrace with the decline of advertising, I think that you have a chance for news organizations to be more responsive than they've ever been before.
And they're figuring that out. So I will tell you right now that I just bought 4 new subscriptions. I can't even tell you what my subscriptions are per month. But anyway, I bought 4 new subscriptions in the last week and a half. Why? Because I reached my 3 article maximum. You know how that you get that 3 article maximum a month, and suddenly you realize, oh God, I gotta subscribe to Wired. Oh no, yeah. I have to. And in an interesting way, that is also a great way of saying you do value us. Don't just value us for nothing. Value us. And I realized, you know what? I do value them. I need that fourth and fifth and sixth article. And if I need that article, they need to be able to pay those people to write those articles. So
well,
I want people,
right.
to, and I want people
right.
to know
just,
that that's
they're not getting it from advertising. That's probably never coming back.
Right. We have to stop calling it a firewall. It's not a firewall. It's an invitation wall. It's not a firewall. A firewall implies that somehow you're being walled off. That's not what they're doing. They're trying to survive so that you want to go back because they offer you what you need, which is content yep. and information. And there is so much now, especially with things like the 2020 election, with things like coronavirus, with things like climate change, you need damn investigative reporters that you can trust because too much of the media that you see on TV or on radio is so distorted and there's an agenda. And the agenda is that it's not useful. One of my producers said it's a paywall, Arnie. It's not a paywall. It's an invitation wall. I really still think that that's really what we need to call it. Dan Kennedy, yep. you are wonderful. The title of your piece, which was in part inspired by a New York Times piece, but of course it takes more than one piece to catch my attention, is entitled Burgers, Beers, and a Texas Experiment Points the Way to News as the Hub of Civic Life. I love it. Grab a brewski and talk to a journalist. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. See you next week. You bet.